The International Telecommunication Union is a 160-year-old organization which became an agency of the United Nations in 1949. It coordinates radio spectrum, deals with figuring out communication mechanisms across international boundaries, helps to develop technical standards for communications, and today it even helps coordinate the use of satellite orbits. Now today, our special guest, Waleed Methluthi, is the head of the infrastructure division of the ITU, specifically Future Networks and Spectrum Management. Waleed's experience is remarkable, it really is, as is his academic journey and his journey in the private sector before coming to the ITU. So in this episode, we'll hear Waleed's story, some very interesting stories of his time with Google, with AT&T, and now with the ITU. I'm Philip Gervasi, and this is Telemetry Now. Waleed and Doug, thank you both for joining today. And Waleed, this is a really great opportunity for me to get to meet you. I've been doing so much research for this episode today. So fascinating, your background and some of the work that you and your organization is doing. So thank you. Thank you very much for joining. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Phil, for having me. It's a pleasure. It's really an honor and a pleasure to be here with my friend Doug here. I mean, it's really a great pleasure to be with such a star in the telco world and in the communication world, telecommunication world.
Oh yeah, Doug's a treasure. He is the man who sees the internet, right? Isn't that your nickname, Doug? I believe.
Yeah.
he's shy today. He's being humble. So I do want to know a little bit about how you two are connected. But before we get into that, Waleed, I'd like, for my own sake, because all I know about you for the most part is what I've read online in our couple small conversations that we've had, but I'm very interested in your background, especially in academia. I mean, you do have a terminal degree, your work in private industry, having worked for Google, and then now working for an agency of the United Nations. This is a very interesting journey that you've been on. I'd love to hear it, if you don't mind, and as much as you'd like to share, personal, professional, I'll leave that up to you. But starting, I guess, with your background and even in your journey in academia.
Yeah, I could talk for hours, so there's nothing off limit there. Thank you for the opportunity. I'm actually a physics PhD. I did a PhD in lasers, actually in semiconductor optical amplifiers.
Okay.
In the early 2000s. I started my career as a physics researcher. There was still in the early 2000s the discussion about the Moore's law and how long we can push it and how much integration we could do. And there was similar to what's happening today, actually a power crunch at the chip level. And Intel was really investigating a forefront research project doing silicon photonics and trying to use photons instead of electrons for switching. So I ended my PhD in Canada, in Université Laval, and then I moved into the research laboratory, the silicon photonics research laboratory, with Mario Panicha at that time. Leading that lab. And I remember my first time in 2007 coming into Silicon Valley, and my first day at work, there was this huge press conference, is full of journalists. I was coming in as a new grad. There was these umbrellas they put for shooting and stuff.
Right, yeah.
And I was coming right out of Canada, just finishing my PhD. It's a different reality to join an industry research laboratory, very different from university. Mm-hmm. But I did a couple of years of research in silicon photonics. Very early on, I worked on the first Raman laser. So this is you excite the material and then you get light emission. Intel was able to do it in silica, which is a very interesting part because you could leverage all the electronics industry and fab to use photonics instead of electronics. So that was very, very interesting. But then quickly, I was not really sure what direction to take and what journey in my in my career. And I was still like very attached to academia. I wanted to become like a professor, have my own lab. It's kind of like a dream of every student at that time. So I took back a position, a postdoctoral position at the microphotonics laboratory in Toronto, in University of Toronto. Mm-hmm. Was very excited about it. It was a very interesting opportunity. I got the opportunity to meet great people such as like the later on to become the Nobel Prize professor, the French professor that got the Nobel Prize recently on laser manipulation of materials and stuff. It was really cool to be there. But then my short time in industry got me like a taste of Silicon Valley, and I was really I got the hang of it. And you know, once you're in the valley, like it's really hard to get yourself extracted out of it. Quickly, I was reached out to by AT&T Labs, and there's a small part of the lab that does the applied research that is in Santa Monica, in California, and it worked very closely with the more famous part of the lab, which is in Holmdel in New Jersey. So that's like the kind of the research, and we take what they do and we try to apply it in the network. And when I joined AT&T, they just got the exclusivity of the iPhone at that time, and it was like only AT&T that was doing that. So they turned almost everybody into a wireless engineer. So my boss, I remember my boss coming into my office, it was like, okay, we're not going to do any fiber business. We're not going to do like any photonics. We're done. Everything is wireless now. We need to make sure that this device, this new device works. It had an internal code name at that time in AT&T. They called it Acme. And then everybody was on Acme. One of the things very high priority. I mean, at that time, people were very excited about like this new innovation, this new device, but it was very difficult to make calls. Like all the calls were failing because the network capacity to support all this hype was not there. And AT&T had to like reinvest in its network and do all the necessary. So I became like a wireless engineer trying that kind of like tiger team, trying to help the executive, you know, steer the investment and put more towers here. It was a few fun facts there. During those years, like San Francisco Giants, they were like winning the World Series. So like the ballpark in San Francisco was very crowded. All the executives were going to watch all these games, and they couldn't even like share a photo on text message or something.
Oh, wow.
So they sent me there with like a team to test the network and try to build it up. And like, there was a lot of talk at that time about DAS, distributed antenna systems and stuff. I did a lot of like really hands-on cool deployment. The first couple of years it worked pretty well because I didn't know much about baseball. I had a hard time managing the team because everybody was trying to go there because we had like full access to the ballpark. But after a couple of years, I was as distracted as the rest of the team. I understood the game very quickly and I picked it up. So I did a lot of like wireless work from there. Mm-hmm. 3G, 4G, circuit switch fallback. Had full access to all the logs in the network. I worked with a various bunch of vendors to look into optimizing the network. Big data, Hadoop. We had like all these things coming from the devices into like a massive cluster and trying to optimize and like find out rare events like, such as call drops and stuff like that. It was really fun. I worked very closely with a startup at that time that AT&T was contemplating to acquire, to put like a small piece of software in all our devices and try to extract radio information from the devices. because it's good to have the network view, but it's nothing compared understanding what was going on at the customer side.
For the client side, right.
That had a lot of implication on privacy. Mm-hmm. The project got suspended at a certain time for investigation because we had full access and there's no limit of what we could source, including the payload on the devices.
Oh, wow.
So you had to trust the engineers that they were really looking only at improving the customer experience and being able to understand like the radio parameters there. It was a very interesting play because like I had to deal with the device manufacturers, with the chipset, the application chipset, the radio chipset. It was a very yet nascent industry at that time in the 2010, 2012. I mean, it's ridiculous that I'm talking about it right now. It's only 10 years ago. But like when you see where it was 10 years ago and where it is now, it's a huge, massive... I mean, it looks like I'm talking about prehistoric area.
It is amazing how technology, especially in recent years, changes so fast that it does feel like 10 years ago was ancient history. It really is. I agree with you there.
And then all of a sudden, there was this disruption coming along. Google Fiber came to town and they were deploying fiber and they had like an amazing product. It was like 1 gigabit symmetrical. So upload, download, 1 gigabit, unheard of. That was a time where I think the national average for throughput was like around like 1.6 megabit per second. And then Google was offering like unrestrained 1 gigabit upload and download.
Yeah, this is around 2012 or so?
2012, 2013, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It was Provo, Utah, and then they extended to Kansas and when I joined, we were deploying in Kansas, and then we decided somehow mysteriously to jump to Austin. That was a big mistake. But I jumped ship at that point because I was really, my background was optics. I was really long into my original, background of physics and lasers and fiber. And I really liked the project, Google Fiber. So I jumped it around 2013, and I kind of like led the network architecture piece of Google Fiber, design and actually the architecture, the outside plant, but also like the network architecture as well. So both at the IP level, but also at the construction level as well. We had a lot of challenges digging, and I was talking about Austin, like it was. After Kansas, we went to Austin, and it was like kind of like flagship city. But somehow, the decision was made by marketing and business, not really consulting engineers. And Austin sits on a bedrock. It's like probably the worst city that you would choose for like digging fiber.
Yeah.
And we had to try to dig and like deploy this product that everybody wanted. But it was a very interesting challenge for a network architect because I had to come up with alternative solutions. So we were investigating solutions like free space optics, so shooting lasers from rooftops to kind of to condominiums, so to a set of like big apartments, big number of apartments. And it made sense from a capacity and a product perspective because it was a short distance laser shot, so reliable, and there was enough business because we were trying. We were trying to offer all this capacity at the end that it would make sense to aggregate that through laser links. Solutions like that, we built our own, horizontal drilling in the lab, and then we were trying to deploy it to accelerate the digging and automate some of it. We were trying to. Well, a big challenge at that time that I took on with the team was to try to understand the infrastructure that has existed in the underground and map it, right? Because I don't know if you remember those days, like every other day there was like a water main hit by our construction crew and Google brand was in the news every other day. Oh, look at what they're doing. And all these like, legacy or I would say like incumbent ISPs, they would jump right on that event and say like, oh, we're telling you, they don't know what they're doing. They're just a bunch of kids trying to like offer you internet, but they don't know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. So we developed like this kind of artificial intelligence or machine learning, I would say, automation using different radars to try to sense what was there while the crew was going, to understand where are the pipes, where's the water pipes, the gas pipes. It was very interesting time also because like we had a lot of interesting arguments with the incumbents when we were trying to put like our fiber aerial deployment in poles, and there was like this regulations where you had to be like you know, 1 foot under the main like a couple of foot under the main utilities, and then 1 foot under the incumbent, and you had to wait for like AT&T engineers to come and sign you off so you could deploy your fiber.
We were
playing on the regulation with local municipalities and stuff. Very exciting times, you know. But unfortunately, with the evolution of with the deployment that was getting slowed because of like different various reasons. I mean, the project was scaled down. Mm-hmm. I mean, in hindsight. I don't know if it's scaled down or not, because like the national average for throughput was bumped by like, I think 10 times. And now AT&T was catching up. The incumbents were catching up. Comcast deploying DOCSIS very quickly. They had like a similar product. They upped their game, and they were offering 1 gigabit per second as well. In Austin, for example, our crew was going to like high-end multi-dwelling units, and the AT&T crew would be waiting right at the door when the crew finishes to come in and put their own fiber. So in hindsight, like I think it was very beneficial to Google and to the what they call them, like the over-the-top players or something. Very beneficial because at that time. The Google, to simplify the Google business case, was directly proportional to the amount of traffic. The more traffic, the more ads printing, and the more revenue. Right. So it had like a strategic goal in really increasing that number, and that's why they created Google Fiber. I think. I mean, this is a personal opinion. All right.
Yeah, understood.
Not from Google. This is like a few years back, like understanding and looking back at the business. So it was a massive win for Google because like after a couple of years of existence of Google Fiber, we had like the national average go like 10 times up, and that was bringing massive benefits for players like Google, Netflix, etc. For almost free. I think the overall budget for our deployment was around $8 billion. But if you think about it, like $8 billion is just a drop in the bucket. Or really like having this national,
right, relatively
US
speaking,
level,
right.
You know, ISP level, and try to push the incumbents to put more CapEx in their network. AT&T was deploying fiber. Comcast went on with DOCSIS and then DOCSIS 3.1, et cetera, et cetera. So it was a huge success, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Probably not for the engineers that wanted to really like build a full-on ISP with like many other aspects, but there's still a lot of work to do. Like, believe me, I think till the day of today, I remember in those days, I was hanging around like San Francisco, like some very touristic areas such as Hayden, Ashbury, very known neighborhood. I was not able to get more than 4 megabit per second. It's kind of
weird
valleys and dips in San Francisco. And the only available infrastructure there was ADSL, like old copper lines. I think till the day of today, it's the same. And then if you're in that dip and you don't have very good coverage, so your cell phone doesn't have really good connectivity. So still, even in San Francisco today, there are areas where connectivity needs a major update, let alone like second tier, third tier cities all across the country where I think back in the days we were exploring things with Google, like things like 5G related fixed wireless access, shooting like direct millimeter wave links and stuff. But there's still a lot of work to do at the country level.
But you were at Google for some time, for some years. What was it that sparked an interest, or at least the opportunity, to move to the ITU, the International Telecommunication Union? I mean, you went from, you know, academia to a huge, you know, company like AT&T to even, you know, I don't know how big Google is compared to AT&T necessarily, and then on to the United Nations itself. So I'd love to hear how that transition happened.
So interestingly enough, when I joined Google, it was very small at that time. It was not big yet. And Google it was really like a small startup. I witnessed Google go like 10 times. Then at the time when I joined, it was around 15,000. And then when I left there, it was around like 150,000 people working for Google. It was a massive. It was pre-Alphabet. I lived through the Alphabet transformation. Post-Alphabet, crazy stuff. So Google Fiber had to put like a brake on the on its expansion and its plans. So I took on a different role at the Next Billion User Unit in Google, like taking more of an international role, trying to find a solution how to improve connectivity worldwide and working on the global scale for Google Network. And one of the ideas was to leverage the revenue that we were getting from ads to deploy actual infrastructure in underserved areas, so subsidize Wi-Fi. So in the same way you look at YouTube and subsidize, like make the YouTube business case work by watching, trading your attention for a few seconds to watch an ad to generate that revenue so you can have all these infrastructure send a video to you. We were trying to do the same for Wi-Fi. We would trade your attention to look at an ad every now and then that will hopefully pay for deploying the access point and like the backhaul and et cetera. And I took on a role as like an architecture lead for that global network. It was also fun. We deployed fiber in Ghana, in Uganda. I deployed the Wi-Fi networks in India on the train stations. We were responsible for 4% of the global internet traffic in India. We scaled that to Nigeria, took that down to South Africa, was deploying networks in very dangerous slums of Africa, Guguleto, Khayelitsha. I mean, it sounds familiar to anyone. I mean, there was active shooting in some places where I was deploying networks, Wi-Fi networks. And then that also got scaled down because it didn't really work. That assumption that you could like subsidize, you know, take some of the revenue from the application layer, bring it down to the infrastructure and try to make it sustainable, didn't really pan out because you needed to deploy in very dense areas for the business case to make sense.
Yeah.
You can print more ads because the ad price was going down. Mm-hmm. And that actually went against the premises that you need to go in less dense area to expand the network connectivity. That was kind of the goal. So it didn't really work. So they scaled down. So I had to take on another role with Google Cloud, optimizing Google data centers, the Google Global Network. I did that a couple of years, but it didn't feel right. It didn't feel like it. I was really passionate about like building networks, expanding networks, having impact through like bringing internet to underserved areas. Mm-hmm. And working on cloud services felt like it was a very mature project that was going to mature markets and their need to compete with AWS, et cetera. It was not really my thing, even though it was interesting from like a technical perspective.
Sure.
I was like, hey, how can I find impact at this point after all these years in the Valley, after all these different experiences? And one of the ideas I was like contemplating was like I looked at what the UN was doing and it looked really interesting. I thought like through the UN, we could really work with developing countries and build skills in these countries and build network engineers and help them come up to speed and understand like how you can manage a network and what kind of regulation you need to put in place and how you could put it together so you can really build your own while working with external partners. And because like there was no other way to expand internet in the underserved areas if it's not done by the local communities. That was kind of my assumption. And, you know, naively, I assumed, okay, like if you jump in a UN role, you have impact because you have like really direct access to these decision makers
right. That
influence the regulations. And then bring in my kind of unusual background for the UN, like with technical know-how and being in Silicon Valley and having seen how these decisions are made and how the technical aspects of the deployments, et cetera.
What is your role specifically now?
So now within ITU, so ITU is the, as you mentioned earlier, the International Telecommunication Union was founded in the 1865.
Mm-hmm.
When the telegram was invented,
yeah,
they felt they needed an institution that will work between countries to kind of harmonize, because telegram was going across countries, so they needed some sort of international bodies to coordinate that. So it started with the telegram. It evolved into this role with the radio communications when the radio waves were invented, Marconi in 1900. So naturally, it found itself as the organizations that coordinated also like the radio telecommunication
okay. And
managing the interference, making sure that at the international level, like the communications are coordinated correctly. And then it became a UN specialized agencies in the 1950, mm-hmm. Around the 1950. And then it evolved into this role to manage space orbits, because in the 60s, the only communication from satellites was using radio frequencies and radio transponders. So ITU found itself in that spot to manage the interference levels, and it inherited by that the management of the space orbits. So today, ITU, if you want to send a satellite up in the sky, up in space, you need to file for ITU orbits, and there's studies, and they will look into the interference. So it found itself as the organization that coordinates that as well. And then in the 80s, they started adding layers to that. So that's the historical radio sector, and that manages radio frequencies and space orbits. Then it evolved into they added another sector for the standardization, because they felt like with all these now vendors and operators, they needed some sort of like standards to make sure that the communications are going are coordinated correctly across borders. So they added the standardization sector on top of the radio sector, the historical one, and the standardization sector did such a great job. It is actually the body that is behind the standards for the WDM standards, wave division multiplexing, which is the frequency grids that is defined for the lasers that go in the subsea cables. So like all the traffic around the world is carried in these modulated lasers. And there's a bunch of them that go in a fiber, and the grid, the exact grid on where you place those lasers and how you modulate them is defined by an ITU standard. There's a bunch of also fiber to the home standards defined by ITU. I think the standardization sector did really, really well in being an instrumental and critical actor in the expansion and making the internet really develop and grow. Very, very interesting work that has been done. And the very interesting work that is still ongoing, even though now it expanded completely into everything. Which is, I don't know if it's really beneficial to the organization, but anyways. And then the latest sector, was at a certain time, I think in the 90s with the internet boom. Many developing countries were witnessing this explosion of internet and technologies, and they felt left out. So they're like, hey, we need a development sector where we could, like the ITU, from the other sectors, from the regulation and from the standardization, could come and build capacity in these developing countries and help out the developing countries make the right choices on how to leverage these technical advances to really have economical growth in these countries, because we need these technologies to be able to build our economies, and we need to build capacities, and we need to build personnel and technical expertise to be able to catch up. So that's how the development sector, or ITUD or BDT, I think it's coming from like the French historical background. Many names in ITU are in French. Actually, in these international negotiations, what they do, French name is actually the default one for prioritizing the alphabetical order of things, which is something very strange. It takes a couple of years to get. Anyways, so they built this BDT sector. And so the BDT sector is, the role is to take these technologies, ICT technologies, and try to help developing countries based on their requests, understand them, grasp them, and implement them in their territories in order to drive economical growth, and build development, create jobs, etc. So I'm part of that development sector. And in the development sector, I lead a very unique division called Future Networks and Spectrum Management and Future Networks. So my role is to help these countries and these decision makers and the regulators understand what is spectrum management, how you can manage your spectrum bands, in line with the international regulations, how you can build capacities. I build tools for them that I make available for free, almost for free, to be able to understand and manage the complexity of different spectrum bands, leverage them for different technologies, IMT technologies, 5G, 4G, where to allocate things. Have an international role in coordinating between countries. For example, recently in the African continent, we got 54 countries to agree on a treaty for cross-border interference levels and implement that using software that all the administration can take and use the same calculation method to understand the level of emissions. And the future technology parts involve understanding where's the internet going, what are the next technologies, how to leverage, how to understand fiber deployment in your country, what best last mile connectivity solutions you could use, how you can integrate new technologies such as direct to cell satellite, these LEO constellations. It could go also all the way to cover quantum communication, quantum encryption, things like RPKI, how to secure your network. Really at the infrastructure level, I'm not venturing too much into the application layer of the Aussie model.
Right.
We do a little bit of DPI right now, digital public infrastructure, which is a big thing as part of the push at the high UN level. To have this kind of digital public infrastructure for countries that you could put building blocks on top of it for digital identity, digital health, digital services for the governments. So I had that division that is really at the cross border of the different sectors, because I need to interact a lot with the historical radio sector, with the standardization sector. Distill all that, bring it to the member states, and try to advise them and build products for them and services for them in a way that they can leverage technological advances in the ICT technologies and build growth. And a lot of that is also building capacity building curricula. So I do a lot of now a little bit going, closing the circle, going back to my academia days. I build courses about infrastructure mapping, how does the internet work, about space connectivity, how does this thing 101 satellite connectivity. And I put that on the ITU Academy and I try to make them available for everyone who's interested in taking these courses.
I wanted to ask a question. You brought up a number of topics, but one that you mentioned, the spectrum management as it relates to satellite communications. So this is a topic that is top of mind a lot. A lot of people think about SpaceX and Starlink is a very famous technology now. And even though satellite internet has been around for decades, you know, there are reasons why the low Earth orbit constellation technology is really cool. One thing that I encounter maybe every other day is somebody saying, well, like, well, why can't Starlink work in country X? And there's not a technical reason. The satellites are essentially covering the whole, surface of the Earth as far as where any people are. And then it becomes an issue of the spectrum as managed through the ITU. And then, again, depending on the country, there may be a license that's required through the telecom regulator of that country. So you could have two, there's different configurations here. But I find that people are not familiar with this obstacle of that they can't just turn the service on, whether it's Starlink or Eutelsat or Viasat or any other, satellite operator. While technically they could radiate to a ground terminal anywhere in a footprint of one of their satellites, in some locations they haven't satisfied these other requirements of the spectrum management or the license, and therefore to honor that they're supposed to not. Sometimes that doesn't completely happen, But anyway, do you encounter that people don't appreciate the role here? Because I feel like I'm doing my part in trying to let people know that there's all these other steps that have to occur to connect.
It's a huge can of worms, man. Like you started like a huge discussion here. Like there are multiple layers to it, many layers to it. I'm trying to kind of like take a step back to see where I could start. So the demand is massive. Like you, every other day, I have questions from member states, from regulators in countries who have no clue about the different applications of all this. It's really a disruptive technology coming up. Broadband satellite with this massive kind of constellation is really a new thing. And very few regulators and very few actually operators are equipped with the right understanding and the right skills to really make the right decisions. Now, Technica, as you mentioned, like you can blanket the Earth and then you can have service anywhere you want. But like there are many implications. We can't like offer telecommunication services anywhere. Like we can't. I mean, I think I remember back in the days when I was doing testing with AT&T, I used to have like a Yagi antenna, and if I wanted to bring down a cell site, I would like shoot like a 2.5 gigahertz from my little generator, shoot it straight up at the antenna and then bring it down, bring the whole service down. No one would be able to make a single call. So interference is a major thing. And then there are operators in all these markets that invested a lot of CapEx and a lot of like money based on a business case to apply for licenses and like be able to operate at these frequencies. So I can't just show up and like start like my service and saying like, hey, I can give you like a better deal. That's not how it works. So the construct of this is that at the international level, the ITU sets the rule of like frequency bands and which services are used for which bands. Now it's at the local level, like the government or the regulator and the national regulator decides how to allocate those bands in accordance with international radios. So there are different ways. So if you want to run, like I think for SpaceX, for example, if you want to run a service in the United States, you have to apply to the FCC. The FCC will make sure that whatever you applied for is in line with the ITU regulation, or will do some application for you at the FCC level if you want to like own some orbits or own some resources or like operate certain frequencies. So that's kind of the play between the local and the international role. So applying for ITU does not give you the right to go and like provide service at a certain territory, you have to also work out your way through the national administration as well, who has like the jurisdiction to manage its own resources as well, in accordance with international regulations. So we have instances, for example, where some countries, like for example, Iran, went to the radio the radio board, RRB, with an ITU to complain about like Starlink providing access there, and then
I was going to ask about this case.
And of course, like, you know, per the regulations and per the international coordination rule, ITU notified the national administration. You have to understand, ITU came from like the 60s, where like, you know, in the space industry, it was like countries. There was no commercial operators. So the administrations were responsible for the damage that you could do by sending your satellite if it creates like physical damage or like also like interference there. So they notify the administration, and the administration needs to make sure that it's abiding by the international treaties.
So, on this case, if I could back up. So what, for people who don't know what we're talking about here, this goes back to the fall of 2022, when there were the protests in Iran about the young woman that was killed in police custody for wearing her hijab incorrectly. There were many days of internet shutdowns, internet curfew. We were involved in reporting on this as well. And as happens with every one of these cases on social media, especially on Twitter or X, there's people tweeting at Elon Musk saying, use Starlink to turn the internet back on in this country or this other country. And I think he loves that. And he's like, well, maybe we just might do that. You know, he wants to respond to this. And in this case, and I've seen this because I cover this, so I'd seen it about 20 times already, where some, you know, this big campaign to kind of enlist Starlink to turn a service on. Well, they supposedly did it in Iran, where they actually turned it on without going through the ITU to get the spectrum authorization, without going through the Iranian government to get a license or whatever is required to provide telecommunication services in that country. They turned it on, so that, you know, technically is flouting whether we call this international law, this treaty-based, you know, system. So Iran then takes, you know, on their own, they collect evidence. I guess they get their own terminal. They test that it works. They take the evidence and bring it to the ITU to complain. And the ITU essentially said, correct me if I've got any of these details wrong, I think they kind of just said, okay, we'll accept your evidence, and we're just going to convey the message on to, I think it's Norway and the United States are the two governments that represent SpaceX internationally, that you should have them turn the service off in Iran. I don't know that they've done anything. It's there is no enforcement mechanism in this. We don't have a one world government. You know, I guess the one thing that SpaceX Starlink, I would think from my perspective, again, I have a very simple understanding of this, was that, you know, the spectrum allocations that they have are valuable to them. And there are, those allocations only exist as long as the ITU's spectrum management is the rule of law. So the more they want to upset that apple cart, they've got a lot to lose if everybody just decides, we'll just all do our own thing. So it's a risky thing, and I don't know how. It's publicly written, like what the decision was. I'm not sure what action Starlink took or didn't take. Do you know? Did they turn the service off?
I think the GFA's their terminals, and they were not offering the service anymore.
Okay, so they're complying with the decision of the ITU. That's interesting.
You know, like that's so. I want to make a message very clear here. Like ITU is not enforcing tracking down, or ITU does not have a position of like supporting, internet tracking down, bringing down internet in countries. We are, ITU, it plays a role to make sure that things stay coordinated at the international level. The internet or the international connectivity is not based on one operator. It requires like a bunch of operators, similar to how the internet was built. So we need that coordination. And we need to work out through the also the local administration. And we need to have things, you know, coordinated internationally. And that's what the ITU role is. But like we're not, ITU is not responsible for the decision of a country of like to turn off or a service or turn off like a certain, connectivity. We're not part of that discussion. We're at the technical level.
Yeah, I've seen some criticism along those lines, and that but I mean, I guess the concern I see is if you were to then start dictating to, you either have to kind of represent. Faithfully represent the sovereign government of Iran, or you're in a position where you're telling them they can't do something. And the more you start telling these countries they can't do something, then they can just leave. You know, they don't have to, like you risk the thing just coming apart. You'd rather have them at the table. It's like the UN. North Korea has a table at the UN. It's better that they're there than they're not there, so that we can have a discussion to resolve something, or you know, this is I think our understanding of international relations. But yeah, the more you have a balance you have to strike there, where you want them to be represented, so that they stay engaged.
It's very, very political, because so, there's like a mechanism. This goes like a radio resolution board, the RB. The radio resolution board is voted, so it's at certain countries they vote, and there are certain countries there that sit there to take these decisions, and then it gets revoted every 4 years, I think. So there's a whole process and administrative process based on like coordination between all these countries, and it's very, very political, very, 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 very heavy, very slow. And as you mentioned, there's no enforcement mechanism. You know, there's a decision, but like the ITU does not enforce it. ITU gives like, hey, this is the decision at the international level. And this is what has been agreed by the member states. And then you have to look into ways of how to implement that. But they don't force anyone to implement it. But there's a cost, as you mentioned. If you don't, that means that you're not part of the treaty, or you don't really recognize that treaty, and then it gets really complicated. Well, one thing that I really wanted to finish on that, that you brought up, and I think you're also involved in that quite a bit, Doug. The space, the satellite connectivity is all about terrestrial network. And the challenge for Starlink is that it is not clear how the traffic gets routed at the terrestrial level. And where are the the terrestrial stations where the traffic goes to space? In many of the developing countries, there's no terrestrial station per country, so it goes across borders. So taking a step back, one of the challenges when I was deploying like these Wi-Fi networks with Google. And there were open Wi-Fi networks. All you had to do to connect is to watch this this ad, and then you're connected. You would be surprised how many malicious actors would take on these connectivity and try to do bad things. One of the main drivers for the traffic in India, and sorry for being this direct, was like pornography. And some of it was juvenile pornography. Like some people will come to, the train platforms and will upload content and will start doing like these things. And we needed to track these things because in India and in most of the countries around the world, that was not okay. And it should not be okay. We should be able to. So we needed to implement at the network level a way of enforcing legal intercept. So if there was, let's say, a subpoena from the judge, that was making sense. We're not here to enter in the judicial part, but like if there's a judge who judged that this activity is not legal, then with a subpoena, we need to be able to like track the logs and give them to law enforcement. And in ITU, we were doing like a dump of all the NAT binding records and the stuff, and we were giving it to the government. I mean, India is a particular country to operate networks in, but like we were doing our part to like give all the logs that were able to help you to stitch in a case of a malicious thing, to stitch the connectivity and retrace it back to the device or to the MAC address or et cetera, right? Now, if we take that same challenge and we extrapolate that now to like the LEO connectivity, now the problem, a lot of the concerns in these countries, and even in many countries, they don't even, are not even aware of these challenges, is that when something bad happens with these networks, and let's say like terrorists or like malicious actors are leveraging these networks for certain activities, the local administration should be able to kind of like retrace back based on like their judicial, process, etc. The problem is that this spans over borders, and in the most of the cases, there is not even a terrestrial station where the traffic is exchanged. So it goes immediately, like, I don't know, traffic in Botswana will go and be exchanged in Kenya. So there's no way for you to really be able to, so it's not a traditional thing. So there are discussions right now with the regulators to see what is the best practice to regulate this. Should we enforce these operators to have like a local terrestrial station in country where the network is, where the traffic is exchanged, so we can at least have kind of some sort of control in case we need to. I mean, the problem is not only in developing countries, it's more exacerbated in developing countries because they don't have like the technical skills to look into this. But even in the United States, I mean, recently, I'm not sure like how the FCC is enforcing whatever Starlink connectivity, because like the traffic could be routed, I don't know, in Colombia or another place for like national traffic. So, and when I was having discussions with a regulator, the FCC, they're not really aware. There was no clear mechanism how to enforce these things.
Well, the U.S. Lawful intercept system was completely hacked recently, so maybe it's for the best. They probably assume it's all coming down back in the United States, and probably, you know, that's probably a good assumption for. But it's not guaranteed.
It's not guaranteed. I know some of this because, like, the terrestrial network of Google Cloud and Google is the one actually powering up Starlink. Starlink is taking a ride on Google Cloud and Google infrastructure. That's not public information. I'm not sure if I'm allowed actually to share it, but probably if you dig in the internet, you'll find some information about it. The problem is that the footprint of the Google Cloud, it's like a cloud operator. So it's designed not to have like coverage in every country. It's not an ISP, right? But that information is hidden. So if you present a request for Starlink, and this based on my knowledge 5 years ago, so I don't know if it's still the case, but if you present a request for Starlink to understand how the traffic was routed, Starlink would go to Google and ask for Google logs. So you are supposed to know that you're presenting a request not to Starlink, but actually to Google, who is a terrestrial operator of empowering the Starlink. So you see, like, there's a lot of complications in this, and it's not really very well regulated. It's still like the Far West, and we need really, I mean, network engineers should come in and like sit together and like try to find the best way how to kind of have get this sorted out, like in the old days of the internet, where we're trying to like route traffic through BGP and like have like these things exchange and the information exchange from switches to switches, etc. I have a look at it from a technical background. I don't want to add the political layer when it's in a case of a war and stuff like that. That part I don't want to get involved in. And I'll stop here. The last part also, like, it's the commercial part, right? I still don't see a direct sustainability path for operators like Starlink. Because when you come in countries, the areas where the ARPU is making sense are the dense areas where already operators are investing massively CapEx to offer 5G and stuff like that and buy very expensive licenses. Now, in the less denser areas, the business case is really hard to make sense. And that's why we have 3 billion people that are not connected today, because it's really hard to make money when you build the infrastructure there, right? I mean, the LEO constellation is even more expensive from an infrastructure.
And they have to replace the satellites every couple of years. I mean, they don't have long lifelines. Nothing lifetime. You can't have something in low Earth orbit that lasts that long. Eventually, it comes back in.
Well, it's not clear to me that till the day today, maybe I'm not part of like this hype, but it's not clear to me how it's going to make sense. I mean, like deep pockets could make it sense, and probably at scale, when you have like, I don't know, maybe 100 million users in the network, it will start making sense. But I'm still struggling to see it. I would like to see the numbers. I run the numbers multiple times. And I mean, when the regulators come to me and ask me, I'm like, this is not a silver bullet. We can build like maybe a resilient network, a combination between terrestrial, wireless, you know, and a satellite connectivity where everything comes together, and then you can have a fallback mechanism between the different technologies to make it work seamlessly. I think the iPhone recently announced that they will be supporting the satellite, direct-to-satellite connectivity, even though it's still not standardized at the ITU level. It's not regulated. It's coming up, I think, in the WRC.
Right, understood.
2030. But eventually, okay, it may make sense. But for now, it's like just tea pockets.
Yep, right.
You know, yeah, that must be my personal opinion. Okay, it's not an IT opinion. I don't want to get in trouble.
So as we're getting closer to wrapping up, Waleed, I'd like an update on the progress, maybe even some of the challenges that you're encountering with the Giga project, which is a little bit of a departure from what we're talking about with, you know, low Earth orbit satellites and things. And we're talking about how the ITU is involved in enabling and serving underserved areas with internet connectivity. So yeah, give us an update on the Giga project, if you would.
All right. So the Giga project is a venture between two UN institutions, UN agencies. ITU, which is the telco, international telecommunication, and UNICEF. So we noticed that in many countries, like I think the official recent number that was published by ITU is 2.4 billion people that were not connected, absolutely not connected, so they're not online. And part of that, like a big part of that, is actually children. So it's a huge problem to understand how we can bring connectivity to these schools, mostly in the rural areas. And UNICEF and ITU combined efforts and came up with this Giga project to try to bring connectivity to schools all around the world. The first part of that is to understand quantify the problem. We started by trying to understand where are the schools. And as surprisingly enough, it's a question as simple as that is very complicated to answer. Many of the countries do not have a grasp of the location and the exact whereabouts of the schools. So we started by UNICEF started working by like identifying the lat long and the location of the schools and if the school was still operating or not. Once we are in a good understanding of that part, we need to understand if the school is connected or not, which is even a more complicated question to answer. We were working with like maybe Doug is familiar with these guys, MLAB, and like some sort of like trying to collect telemetry and understand the state of connectivity in these schools. So it's a very hard question to answer to. Is the school connected or not? What is the level of connectivity of the school if it's connected? Is there electricity or not? And now we're slowly getting into like trying to understand like the infrastructure that is available near those schools. And that's the role of ITU. And that's the role of my team, as we are responsible for mapping the infrastructure, the ICT infrastructure around the world. And we collected a lot of information over the years, over the past 10 years, about infrastructure availability all around the world, terrestrial fiber, wireless connectivity, the towers, et cetera, et cetera. So then ITU comes in and try to understand how far these schools are from the existing infrastructure. Let's assess the location, the level of connectivity, and then what ICT infrastructure is available. We map all that, and then we run through like a standard exercise of network planning, network design, and business planning around that. So my team is making tools available into like to actually design the gap based on the end state. And if we know the location, we know the existing infrastructure, we know the street map and the street infrastructure, and we try to route some sort of like the best network and the less expensive capex. Should we do like direct wireless connectivity? Should we do fiber connectivity? And we collect data to put like kind of a business plan around it. And then we try to find the investors and the government procurement players to support them. And UNICEF plays mostly that role because they're massive in their presence with the countries, and they're massive in helping countries procure solutions, including a vaccine for kids. In this case, we help them like procure network equipment with working with countries and investors. So the role of ITU and my team is to bring, de-risk that barrier and make it more grounded into like more of a network engineering exercise by doing design and planning and business estimations. This is the stuff I used to do with Google and with Google Fiber as well. Brownfield, right, greenfield, yeah. Stuff. Well, I mean, it's very challenging to really get this to expand. You know, ITU is a 160 years institution. It's really entrenched in its inertia and its massive processes. You add to that UNICEF, which has like another layer of really crazy administrative processes, and you try to bring those two together into this agile kind of like project, which is Giga. Man.
Yeah, it's a noble endeavor, but but frustrating to actually carry out with all of the bureaucracy. And like you said, the inertia, these two behemoths coming together, and the inertia of that is very difficult to overcome. But certainly, Doug, I can't speak for you, but I'm going to speak for you. We're both very glad that you're there and doing the work that you're doing.
I'm trying, man.
Well, Waleed, it's been a pleasure speaking with you today, getting to know you a lot more, learning about the ITU and your work there, of course. Very fascinating, very informative. Doug, do you have any closing comments or questions for Waleed?
No, thanks for coming on. It was a good discussion.
Yeah, and we rely on your help, Doug and guys. I mean, there's no way, I mean, we could do this alone. I mean, we need like private players and private sector, and we desperately need more, partnerships and collaboration. The UN is just the tip of the iceberg of this. I think for me, I remain a firm believer that it's the private sector with the right incentives and with the UN trying to reduce the barriers to access and these markets and, deregulate safely most of it to allow kind of a marketplace, a vibrant marketplace. That's the only way we could solve the problems and, have universal, meaningful connectivity. Eventually, that's kind of the goal for like 2030. I appreciate the help and the partnership, guys. Really, Doug.
Our pleasure. So for our audience, if you have an idea for an episode of Telemetry Now, or you'd like to be a guest on the show, love to hear from you, you can reach out at telemetrynow@kentuck.com. So for now, thanks so much for listening. Bye-bye.